live from the Berkshire International Film Festival and the world premiere of The Big Dan Koski, a film about a guy who goes on a seal hunt, kills a sailor, adopts a Belgian kid, marries Isabelle Huppert, and then realizes he's a woman. I'm Kyone Wolf. We've gone to Hollywood in a quaint New England way. Once a year, film industry big shots, legendary actors, and up-and-coming filmmakers converge on Great Barrington. And this year, we've joined them. And now, his thriller about parrot smuggling is in pre-production. Colin McEnroe.
Okay, I'm trembling with excitement. Part of that is because I don't usually drink coffee, and I had some, because there's a lot of stimulation here. We are at the Berkshire International Film Festival in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. I've always wanted to do this. We've done it today. The festival has delivered big time with some very exciting guests. You're going to be meeting a lot of people as we go along here, so stay along for the ride here. And I'm going to introduce the first group that we've got here. I don't have any notes in front of me, so I'll probably screw things up, but I think I'll be fine. The director of We Still Live Here, which is a documentary about the Wampanoag language, and it involves Jesse Littledoe Baird, who edged me out for a MacArthur Genius Grant this year. I'm still a little annoyed about that, but it's about the revival of the Wampanoag language, and you know it as a golf club in West Hartford, but it's actually a Native American tribe, and teaching the Wampanoag language to people who are alive now and aren't Wampanoag. I'm probably doing a poor job of summarizing all that, but a creator of that and make pieces with us. Sitting next to her, we're up kind of in a loft. If you hear noise, we're in a little loft over the Triplex Theater in Great Barrington, where many of the films are screened. And we wanted you to feel like you were at a festival, so we're trying to have some ambient noise and distractions as well. Sitting next to Anne Makepeace is Pamela Yates. She is the director and creator of Granito, which sounds like a delicious, maybe iced dessert of some kind, but it really isn't. It sounds like something you would order, though. You know, I'll have a Granito. It's a movie about her experiences. It's about coming back to Guatemala, having done another documentary there in 82, I think, right?
Right, and the full title is Granito, How to Nail a Dictator.
Coming back and sort of making another documentary and to certain degrees a documentary about documentaries as well. And then sitting next to her is the director of Kinyarwanda. Alfred Brown is the director of that. This is a narrative film, but it involves the tragedies of Rwanda, but it also involves kind of the stitching together, kind of maybe almost in the mode of a movie like Crash, a movie sort of stitching together a lot of different stories of people trying to get through what happened in Rwanda. How did I do describing that one?
Was pretty good.
Yeah, close enough anyway. Yeah. All right, you'll have many opportunities to improve on my explanation. And then the producer, Marco Lundiner of On the Ice, also a narrative, a fictional film shot in under extreme conditions in Barrow, Alaska. You'll hear a little bit about that, about people who go on a seal hunt, three people, young people who go out on a seal hunt, and only to come back. You'll find out a little bit more about that as we go along as well. So that's the lineup. That's all we have time for. Thanks for tuning in today. No, I'm just kidding. I wanted to start in Pamela Yates. I'm going to start with you. This is something we talked about a little bit last night. I think for people who've never been to a film festival and who aren't filmmakers, a question that might pop up right away is, why go to a film festival? What do you get from having your film in a festival like this?
I learn a tremendous amount from the viewing audience who comes to the film festivals, because the festivals are the only place where you really can have one-on-one interaction with the filmmaker. And I see how they see my film, what I was trying to do, what I was trying to create, the reactions that I was trying to evoke from them. And it really helps me both to communicate to other audiences what the film is about, and what I was successful in trying to do in the film, in speaking to people. In the case of Granito, How to Nail a Dictator, the concept of granito, which means tiny grain of sand, is really a Mayan concept, which means that each of us have a tiny grain of sand to contribute to positive social change, that no one is more heroic than another, but that together we can actually make positive social change. And that's at the core of trying to bring genocidaires to justice after several decades.
I want to come back to some of the things you said, but I'd like to get some of the other perspectives about this too. Alfred Brown, what about you? What do you why be in a festival? What do you get out of it?
Well, for independent filmmakers, it's one of the few opportunities that we get to actually connect with our audiences, you know, I agree with that. And it's oftentimes with this distribution means being very complicated. I know that I go to a festival, there's at least a few hundred people in an audience getting to share in that experience. You also get a chance to connect with your peers, fellow filmmakers. It's one of the most inspiring places to be because all the energy and excitement you feel in the Berkshires and every film festival you go to is built off of the dreams of people who just want to tell stories, you know? So it's an exciting place to be.
And some of you already know each other's work a little bit. I think Pam Yates said as she came in that she'd seen And Make Peace your film at Sundance, or was it the other way around?
I think the other way around. I've seen many of Pam's films.
Yeah.
I actually haven't seen this. We've been at the same festivals, I think, four or five times already, and I keep missing it.
Yeah.
May miss it here, and if I miss it here, I'll see it in Nantucket, which is our next festival.
And are we missing anything about the festival experience? I mean, obviously, another thing that a lot of you are in here for juried prizes right now too, and there's, I mean, another aspect of that is to try to win a prize, and that's important, right?
Winning prizes is fantastic. I actually just won a great one on Monday in Telluride, called the Moving Mountains Award, which goes to the film. Actually, the money prize goes directly to the NGO portrayed in the film, which is seen to have the most important impact on social change of any of the films that are in the festival. And that was amazing to me because the film was up against On Coal River, which is about mountaintop mining removal. It was up against a lot of human rights films, but that was an awesome prize. So that immediately goes up on my Facebook page and is, you know, it's great publicity, it's great promotion. So I don't actually even know if I'm up for a prize at this festival, but
I'll check the catalog. It says, Mark Lindner, you actually live up here in this area, and you've been part of this festival a lot. And I mean, another thing that films are here for, some films are looking for a distributor, right, for a way to get seen.
Well, actually, that's one of the things that I find most interesting about BIFF. Unlike some other, you know, film festivals, BIFF is not really a market for films. BIFF is really focused on the filmmakers, on the directors, the writers, the creative element, the creative aspect of filmmaking. And as a festival, I know it fets and celebrates, you know, those components, you know, very highly. It doesn't have the hubbub around it, like, say, a Sundance or a Berlin or Toronto, of the marketplace. And as a result, it can really focus on the filmmakers, connect them with the audience, as everybody else is, you know, mentioning is really important, and put the artistic merits of projects forward. And it doesn't have to get involved in all of the messy sort of deal-making and numbers-chasing and all of that kind of stuff, which can be a real distraction at some festivals, I find, at least.
You know, all of you share, I think, having worked on films that don't have gigantic Hollywood budgets and have some actual constraints on resources and working conditions. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about this. Alfred Brown, I know your film was shot, you know, in a fixed period of time in, among other things, I think, grasshopper mating season. I don't know. What does grasshopper mating season do to your production issues?
Yeah, well, it gives a lot of sound issues and lighting issues. We shot on location in Kigali, Rwanda. We had a 16-day production schedule, and it's a narrative where we have over 1,000 extras, so it was a pretty intense journey. And it's because the film was grant-funded by the European Commission, European Union, and so we had a very tight schedule. But grasshopper mating season is literally that. We were attacked by swarms of over millions, literally. And at times we had to set up lights down on one end of the street to distract the grasshoppers while we were shooting on the other end of the street. It was also rainy season, and I mean, almost every obstacle that a filmmaker could never possibly imagine, we were up against it. And, you know, I guess that's also one of the reasons why, you know, we're proud of the film. Like, you have to go through those extra hurdles, and it gives added value to the whole process.
Well, you said just about everything that a filmmaker can imagine. I think Pam Yates may have one that you didn't have to go through. You want to talk a little bit about working conditions for Granito? I'm trying to get so I can say it a little bit better. Granito.
Well, Granito is filmed in Guatemala, Spain, in the United States. And the story is really about how a film that I made in 1982, When the Mountains Tremble, all of the film and all of the film outtakes is now being used as forensic evidence in a genocide case. While I was making When the Mountains Tremble in 1982, I was able to talk my way onto a helicopter gunship that the general, the head of the Guatemalan Armed Forces, was leading into battle. Mm-hmm. And when we got into battle, we got too close to the side of the mountain, and the guerrilla sharpshooters shot the helicopter down.
Mm-hmm.
Because we survived that, the general gave me access to the armed forces and to combat troops on the ground. And so we were able to film some of the only known footage of the Guatemalan genocide. Okay, fast forward 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing that we now can use, and I actually found some very incriminating evidence to be used in the genocide case.
Mm. Marco, I know shooting in Barrow, Alaska, you were, what, 40 below when you got there?
Negative 40 when we got there,
yeah.
And by the time we left, there wasn't a moment of night. Sometime during prep, we decided that, you know, we weren't going to be able to shoot any night exteriors. Because by the time we got lit, set up, and shot, we wouldn't be able to finish the scene because we'd have 45 minutes of dark left. So we actually rewrote them to be more twilight and whatnot, which is accurate for the area. So it wasn't a huge creatively, but... Yeah, no night and negative 40 when we got there.
And so exposed skin was sort of out of the question, right?
Oh, definitely. You did not leave anything to the elements, so to
yeah.
speak.
And I think I read somewhere that some of the equipment actually doesn't work that well in at such a low temperature, right?
Well, we had to do, you know, rather extensive testing on the film cameras and whatnot because we did shoot on 35 to make sure that they would function. And, in fact, we had to keep the battery blocks in a cooler to keep them warm. Because they would die out in moments if we left them out in the cold. We also had to always travel with both a high-powered rifle for fear of polar bear and with an ice captain, somebody who would show us and make sure that when the wind changed and whatnot and the ice plates would shift, we were out of the way of any collision between the plates. So we were dodging a lot of different aspects of the elements.
We're up here at the Berkshire International Film Festival in Great Barrington. We're live from the film festival today. And Makepeace, I don't know if you had to deal with polar bears or people shooting at you, but I mean, any film you're making like this with a limited budget and limited resources, talk a little bit about what the challenges are.
Every film has a challenge at, I think, every stage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a huge challenge for me in the making of this film was... winning the trust of the Wampanoag people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Native people have really good reasons not to trust outsiders. And also, the story in the film is about this tribe, the ones that actually ensured the survival of the pilgrims back in 1620, bringing back their language, which died 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just in its really nascent state.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very, very protective of the language. They have a policy that the language cannot be used in anything that could be sold, including books, films, etc. And they had guarded it assiduously, and they're the only ones who know it. They're the only ones who speak it. So for them to trust me to make a film about the language and include the language in the film was awesome and was really an honor and was quite a hurdle to overcome. Luckily, I'd met Jesse Little Dobaird and other Wampanoags who were in the film while working on another project and had gotten very close to them and earned their trust. And while that was a historical project that didn't deal with the resurrection of the language, by the time I decided to make this film, I had really strong bonds. But it was a momentous event when the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Program members voted unanimously to let me do the film. So that was the first challenge. And then, of course, fundraising is always a challenge, and the way I deal with that is just, you know, one-person crew, myself and the shooter. That was usually what we had. I would do the sound, and, you know, you beg, borrow, and steal, and meanwhile write a million grant proposals, and you get a little grant, and you keep going. And another big challenge was that Jessie, who is the most amazing woman and has done this amazing thing, said from the very beginning, this film can't be about me.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it's about the language, but there's no way I can tell the story of the language unless I tell your story, because it all started with a dream that she had 15 years ago. And so we'd go around in circles, and that was... there were many challenges. I could go on forever.
You know, through wonderful planning on our parts, or either that or because it just worked out this way, I mean, we really do have four films represented here that are about, to a certain degree, indigenous cultures that are fighting various kinds of extirpation, you know, that either it's language or it's the preservation of language or genocide in really kind of two of the cases. And I guess Pamela Yates also, because we're about to lose you, you're about to go off to an actual screening of Granito. That, you know, as a filmmaker, as somebody identifying your mission, I assume that is part of your mission, is to talk about a culture that in, at least in one country, was being wiped out.
Right. The sole genocide of the Americas in the 20th century took place in Guatemala, and very few people know about it.
Mm-hmm.
What's amazing, though, when I went to Guatemala is I thought I would find a very tragic situation, disturbed people, hopeless, mm-hmm. and I actually found the opposite, which was the inspiration for making Granito. Mm-hmm. People who have never given up on the quest for justice and who have bound together to uncover unknown evidence to do so. And actually, Granito is a very hopeful film. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a film that says we can actually bring... Whoa. We can actually bring these people to account, but we have to do it all together.
Yeah. That might be... don't worry about it. We're at a film festival, so there's people yelling. This is how you know you're actually at a film festival. And Alfred Brown, I mean, obviously there's a natural segue from what she's talking about to your movie going into a situation where I would think the wounds are still very raw. We think of the Rwandan story, obviously, as this almost unimaginable tragedy. How were, as you approach people and say, I want to make a movie, I want to make a narrative movie about this, was it the same kind of thing, that there was more hopefulness than you would have expected to find?
Yeah, I mean, I had the fortunate experience of having lived in other parts of Africa prior to this. And so when I think genocide and tragedies have been things that have been commodified by a lot of filmmakers, mm-hmm. and they often go in and ask, tell us how terrible it was, mm-hmm. as opposed to going and just observing and seeing how things are for yourselves naturally. And naturally, Rwanda is a beautiful place. The people are very warm and positive and hopeful. And our film, the stories in our film came about because people were sharing personal, intimate stories with us that people haven't seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And so the stories were more about life and hope and forgiveness, with the genocide as a backdrop, as a setting, and not necessarily the forefront of what was happening. And so, yeah, you can't do this work, I mean, honestly, without looking at that hope, because Rwanda as a country has used this principles of hope and forgiveness as a way to move ahead.
Mm. And I would think, you're going back to what Ann Makepeace was saying, getting trust has got to be really important as you go into a situation like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for people to be able to share their stories and share themselves with you, there has to be a certain amount of, you know, give. And once that is established, I mean, almost anything is possible.
Mm. You know? All right. Sounds like we're in an airport right now, but we're not. We're at a movie theater. It's called the Triplex. It's in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. This is the Berkshire International Film Festival. We've moved our show up here for the day. There are amazing films here all weekend long. Since Pam Yates is about to go in and sort of oversee a screening of Granito, let me quickly mention that you're going to miss that one today, but it's up again Sunday at 11:15, right?
At 11:15.
And you've got a panel discussion. Quickly mention that.
The panel discussion is called Small Act, Big Change, and we're going to be talking about how human rights films and human rights defenders actually can change the world.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be on that panel with Yvette Albertine, who's the executive director of Witness, and Paco Deonis, who's the producer of Granito, and it's going to be moderated by Alejandro Deonis, who's on the advisory board of the BIF.
All right, we're going to take a little break here. We'll be back. We have to thank Pamela Yates very much for spending some time here before she goes to her screening. We'll be back with more of our other guests, Alfred Brown, Marco Londoner, and Makepeace. You may be meeting a few more people as we go along here. There may be some surprises that I don't even know about. But we're live from Great Barrington, and we'll be back after this. All All right, we're back. We're here at the Berkshire International Film Festival in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. With us, we just said farewell to Pamela Yates. Her film, Granito, is being screened right now. That's the way things are. There's a lot of movies to see. With us is the director of We Still Live Here and Makepeace is with us, Alric Brown, the director of Kinyarwanda, the producer of On the Ice, Marco Londoner, and adding to the conversation is Karen Allen. I don't have to explain to you people who Karen Allen is, one of America's most beloved screen actresses, and she's actually also a big part of the Berkshire International Film Festival. We see her up here every year, working on juries, working on, I assume you're on the board too, right?
I am on the board, yeah.
You know, I want to just talk a little bit, and we talked at the beginning before you got here about sort of, although I think I would actually ask the question to you too. You know, we talked a little bit about why there are film festivals and what, you know, why movie makers come here, why be at a film festival? And you watch so many movies come through this one. I'd like to know, what's your perspective on that? What do you think they get out of a film festival?
Well, I think it gives people an opportunity to see films that they might not otherwise get a chance to see. I think there's a lot of films, you know, the documentaries in particular are, you know, documentaries have such a rough life after they're made in terms of finding audiences and finding acceptance in theaters all across the country. And, you know, a lot of the smaller independent films really, you know, depend on the film festivals to get seen and to get attention. So, and so many of them are such fantastic films that really deserve an audience and really, you know, that's their one hope is to come into the festivals, maybe win some awards or win some audience attention and move out into the world a little more.
You know, I want to expand on that, too, and ask the people who are here. You know, obviously, the summer movie season is about to start. Americans will be probably aware of about 10 movies, you know? I mean, for the most part, in terms of the mass marketing of movies and what the media makes them aware of and what they see commercials for on television, they're going to be aware of 10, maybe generously 15 movies. And there are, I come up here to this festival every year, and I see amazing movies. And I come home, and I see, well, you've got to see this movie called The Owl and the Lark. And it's Vietnamese, and people look at me, what are you talking about? And I'm, first of all, just sort of wondering, do you consider yourself to be in the same business as the people who made Thor? Not that there's anything wrong with Thor, but all these movies that are going to be sort of blockbuster movies, that are going to be mass market movies, and Makepeace, do you feel as though you're part of the same industry as that? Or do you have a whole separate mission, a whole separate reason for being that you can't identify very much with?
I can't say I identify very much with the big blockbusters, no. I've really, since 1995, been a documentarian. Before that, I did work in feature films, but... Mm. When I was working in feature films, I was doing independent sort of cross-cultural stories. A feature that I wrote called 1,000 Pieces of Gold, for example, was, you know, it was definitely in the independent market. And now with documentary, it is a different universe. I mean, where we go for funding, Sundance, ITVS, PBS, small foundations, Ford, who else has luckily funded my film? Anyway, those are places that film... That support films that are about human rights, social issues. They fund films that tell stories that are going to grab people by the heart. It's not like they're funding films that are going to beat people over the head. I don't want to make films like that. I want to make films that move people to care about things they might not have thought about before. And I think that's a whole other... It's not about money. I mean, if it were about money, this is not what I would have been doing.
Alric Brown, what about that? I mean, obviously you want a lot of people to see Kinyarwanda. I mean, that you didn't make a movie that you didn't want people to see.
Yeah, that's actually Alfred Hitchcock's philosophy. He's like, don't make a movie unless people aren't going to see it. That's the whole point of it. But, you know, that we are in a different realm, you know. I think that independent films allow, and festivals allow the independent filmmaker to take risks and chances that big budget blockbuster films don't take. And so when they're not taking those risks, they're often not showing some of those characters, some of those faces, some of those stories that challenge us and that take us to the next level. And interestingly enough, the films in Hollywood that oftentimes do get all the accolades are the ones that take the chances and the risk and challenge us. But they're so few, and they're usually lined with stars and And so it's a very interesting thing. But I mean, I think we're in the same business. Mm-hmm. We're just providing a different service, I think, you know, and our service is important. We're that if Hollywood blockbuster stuff is one thing, we are community theater, so to speak, and we connect with people on a very different level. Mm-hmm.
Marco Londoner, a producer, your perspective on that.
I was going to say, I mean, I definitely consider it very much a business and an industry and see it that way to a large extent. Interestingly enough, in regards to what you're saying about film festivals and whatnot, with the changing of the marketplace and the, you know, alternate distribution avenues and whatnot, the film festivals really do afford films, especially independent films, that opening of the window that for the ancillary markets, for the other types like VOD and whatnot, gets a film out, gets it recognized, puts it on people's map, whereas it may not have the distribution afterwards to really get all those quote-unquote eyeballs and people interested in it. So the festivals also offer that.
You know, this is an incredibly pedestrian and somewhat ridiculous thing to think about, but I find myself thinking about it today. I realized that for years at Blockbuster and places like that, I'd be walking along, and I'd see a lot of those little symbols, those little wreath-like symbols, you know, and you see four or five of them on the box of a movie that you've never heard of before, and you think, wow, I won a lot of prizes at film festivals. Maybe I'll take a chance on it. But I'm not sure now people don't even rent movies that way. I mean, I'm wondering, I mean, how do you call attention now to the fact that you have won prizes at five festivals?
Well, you say with the small amount of advertising budget that exists for independent films, those little winning the prizes at the film festivals really have significance. My film, White Irish Drinkers, won the Audience Award at the Woodstock Film Festival. So just being able, in our little tiny ad, which is up against the three-quarters of a page ad, you know, we can at least have the awards that we've won, and it does draw attention. It's like, won the Audience Award. Therefore, it could be a really interesting film to see, because otherwise you can't compete on the level of, you know, taking out a half-page ad. You're in the little corner, you know, of the page.
And Karen Allen, you've been in blockbusters. And now, I mean, I'm very excited with a name like McEnroe. How can I not be excited about White Irish Drinkers? And it's showing, I think, at noon tomorrow at the Mahawi up here in Great Barrington. But it must sort of feel different in terms of sort of how the odds are stacked. I mean, if you're in Indiana Jones, it's got just a very different feeling from having a movie that maybe you love and care about, but that doesn't have the kind of resources behind it to make sure everybody sees it.
Well, I think actors have it a little easier in the sense that we get to straddle all of these different types of films. So that on one hand, you can do a big, splashy Hollywood film and, you know, that has all of the perks and all of the, you know, you get paid a salary and they, you know, take care of you while you're shooting the film, as opposed to White Irish Drinkers, which, you know, I think it actually cost me money to be in this film. So they couldn't afford to put me up when we were shooting the film, and we shot it in New York City. So, you know, I think in the end, it was like a negative. And the film was made for less than $500,000. So, you know, we had no advertising budget to speak of. So our film sort of began to get a little bit of legs just based on being in festivals. So, you know, it's really been very helpful.
We should mention the White Irish Drinkers also stars Peter Riegert, who's a big fixture also up here at Berkshire Film Festival. And I'm a big Peter Riegert fan from way back. And every time I see him here, I choke. I always want to say, like, hi, I'm a big fan. And I can't even do that. Just walk by me on Railroad Street, you know, an hour and a half ago, and I did the same thing. I froze. You know, and I want to talk to you, the rest of you, a little bit about that, too. Do you feel, Alric Brown, do you feel sometimes as though the odds are stacked against you, that somehow or other you have to sort of, you know, overcome some kind of 20-to-1 odds to get where you want to get?
Well, you know, it's funny because whether you're making a blockbuster or an independent film, the odds are stacked against you, period. I mean, filmmaking is a difficult task. Looking at a blank sheet of paper and figuring out the words that are going to keep people compelled for 2 hours is a momentous task for one to take on in and of itself. And I think anyone who doesn't accept that at the outset is deluding themselves. So everything that comes after that is, you know, it's a part of the game. You know, are things stacked against independent filmmakers a little bit heavier? Yes.
Yeah.
But
if it were easy, I think everybody would do it. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's probably the good thing, actually, is that the cream eventually does rise because it takes a type of persistence. Andrew McLean, who actually directed On the Ice, I went to school with him. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those students that I went to school with at NYU, we see each other at the same places, at the same festivals. Mm-hmm. And not because we went to NYU, not because we know each other, mm-hmm. but it was the work ethic and the amount of time that mm-hmm. these guys put into their writing, into their craft, into development, into growing, that really is the key. All the amount of time we put in behind the scenes to get a project done was so instrumental in us being involved in films in the first place.
I mean, I think you can see it in all aspects of the business, whether it's documentaries or features, mm-hmm. whether it's a director or the lowest crew member. I've literally seen crew members have to be sent home, told they were going to be fired because they continued working with broken limbs, mm-hmm. carrying lights. The work ethic in this business is tremendous. Mm-hmm. And unless you have it and can put that, you know, into the projects, you're going to have a 40-1 odd instead of 20-1.
But, you know, even we were talking earlier today, I was asking you about the cold temperatures up there in Barrow, and you said, I think you mentioned some kind of young filmmakers grant for that involved getting some cameras or something like that.
Panavision was very supportive, yeah.
Yeah. But even then, right, you said that it's very supportive, it's great, you can get the cameras that way. It's kind of what Ann Makepeace was saying before. You get this grant, you get another thing. But you're not, once again, you're probably not going to get the state-of-the-art camera, the thing that just came out that, you know.
No, and I mean, you know, technically, I'm sure, you know, we all found, like, certain circumstances that, you know, had to be finessed and whatnot. And to a certain extent, depending on the type of project, that can add an allure to it. sometimes, you know, serendipity just gives you something you couldn't have hoped to find, mm-hmm. When, you know, working against certain odds. But no, I mean, whether it's grants or, you know, in some states, tax credits or whatnot, whatever it is that can get you down the road to bring the ball to the, you know, to the end point is what you're working with. And you make it work.
Yeah, and I think having the deck stacked against you, it's just like running hurdles, you know. Oh, okay, what is the story here? Oh, God, now I have to do all this research. Oh, now I have to earn the trust of the people that it's about. You know, oh, God, now I've got to write all these proposals and get grant funds. And then, you know, if you're lucky enough to have gotten through a couple of years, this is on, you know, documentary that usually you work on for at least 3 years. Now you have 300 hours of footage. Then the next hurdle is, oh, what? This is not what I thought I was going to get. What is the story here? What am I going to do with this footage? How are we going to structure it? So, you know, there's the whole post-production, which takes another year sometimes, and figuring all that out. And then it's done. And then, hooray, the festivals. This is the big reward, actually. The festivals is the big reward, where we actually get to see the impact of the film that we thought, in this case, I thought it on every single film I've done, but I really thought it on this film was, now they're going to find out I don't know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. You know, I have no idea what I'm doing. And then somehow it gets turned around, the story changes, but evolves into what then you think, oh, this is what it was supposed to be all along, which is probably total rationalization. But at any rate, then when it does move people, mm-hmm. there's just nothing like it. I mean, it's why we do it. You see this audience, audiences have, I don't want to drive anybody away, but most audiences have been in tears. Mm-hmm. My film does have kind of a happy ending, just so you all know, but you know, it's just, it's why we do it. Each of those hurdles, yeah. You know, is what leads to that. And then there's the hurdle of the wider distribution.
Yeah.
Luckily, my films always do get on PBS, and this film will be on Independent Lens in November. But anyway, this is the fun part right now here at this festival. So I'm looking forward to my screening this afternoon at 4:30.
I think if you pull back and look at a project from, what's the phrase, 30,000 feet up or something, it becomes incredibly daunting. And you almost think it's impossible. You lose the forest for the trees. Mm-hmm. But you have to, you know, as you're saying, go one step at a time. You know, this is the hurdle that's right in front of you. You know, if you accomplish that, you can get to the next point. And it's a process of growing. As you grow with the project, it changes, you change. But if you try to pull back and say A to Z, it's overwhelming.
Karen Allen, having been involved with this particular festival for, I think, since its inception, right?
Almost, yeah. I think the first year I was away, but yeah.
Do you feel like you know a different version of the film industry? Do you feel, in terms of what films are? I mean, obviously, you've been around a while and you've seen a lot of different aspects of it, but working kind of intrinsically or closely with a festival like this and seeing so many different projects flying across a range of genre, do you feel like you know what film in America and film in the world is in a slightly different way?
Well, it is a little bit of a different approach. Kelly began asking me to come to Sundance with her a few years ago. And even though I'd been going to festivals for maybe the last, 20 years of my life, usually I was going with a film as an actor in the film. And for me, a lot of times it meant sitting in a hotel room just doing interview after interview after interview, and then you go to your screening, and that's your experience of the festival. I often never got to see other people's films. So I'm now actually starting to experience film festivals from the point of view of an audience member. And usually, in the course of this festival, I'll see as many as six films a day, which is like so delightful. And I go to with Kelly to Sundance, and I'll see maybe four or five, six films a day while I'm there. So it's, it's a whole different experience for me, in which I just become, like a huge fan of the films, and I feel, I feel in the course of like 3 or 4 days that literally it's like the little thing that is on the front of our magazine, we bring the world to the Berkshires. It's, you do feel like you've been on some extraordinary, profound, intellectual, moving roller coaster ride of an experience in the course of 2 or 3 days and visited, cultures and worlds and personal stories, and you just get pulled into a whole extraordinary experience, which I love.
I find that just going to film festivals, I fall in love with these little movies that I know people don't know about, and it's almost I want to nurse them or something. I want to sort of say, I want to bully people into bringing them into markets that anything you can do. It's sort of like,
It would be my only complaint would be is I wanted to see this festival grow in length a little bit so that films could be shown more than once. I know there's a handful that are being shown twice, but it's like I'll see a film and I so much want to tell everybody to go see it, but it's only being shown once. So
we're going to grab a quick break here. We're up in Great Barrington, Massachusetts at the Berkshire International Film Festival. I should quickly mention Karen Allen was referring to Kelly, and that is Kelly Vickery, who's a one-woman whirlwind who basically decided a film festival like this should exist and made it happen. And we're very grateful to her for helping pull things together. And also Sylvia Cancella, who helps me out every year, lining up all these guests and stuff like that. So special thank yous to them. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with a final segment of this discussion after the proverbial this.
Saturday night at the movies. Who cares what picture you see? When you're hugging with your baby, let's roll in a balcony.
Oh, my film? Well, it's sort of a Mad Max apocalyptic thing with Glee-type musical numbers and kind of a Bernie Madoff romantic homosexual love affair with a lobster. And the two of them hide out among the Shakers in Croatia because the shooting costs there were so low. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill with help from Katie Talarski, Mr. Dan Koski, Jean Amatruda, and all of our friends here at the festival, especially Sylvia and Kelly. The part of Bill Curry was played by Christopher Plummer. And now, back to Colin.
All right, we're back. I don't think I've ever done a radio show before with the fumes of popcorn so completely suffusing the air, and I'm having all kinds of really Proustian associations with the delightful smell of movie popcorn, which we found out recently is really bad for you, but eat it anyway. We're at the Berkshire International Film Festival. In fact, I don't have the stamina of Karen Allen. I don't think I can see six movies a day, but already last night we saw a documentary about the New York Times called Page One, Inside the New York Times. This morning, Patrick and I saw a Chilean movie called The Life of Fish, The Lives of Fish or The Life of Fish. I don't know how many lives and how many fish are involved. It's actually, we're talking about people crying. Walking out of that movie this morning there, and how emotional can you get at 9 o'clock in the morning in a movie? But there were people weeping. I actually thought this was a wonderful movie. So here with us, let me just sort of reset the stage for you, Man Makepeace, the director of We Still Live Here, which is about the Wampanoag language, and Jessie Little Doe Baird and her efforts to preserve and even extend the Wampanoag language. Alaric Brown is here. He's the director of Kinyarwanda, which is a narrative fictional film set in Rwanda, kind of a set of interlocking stories about Hutus and Tutsis trying to survive what was happening there. With us also Marco Lundiner, the producer of On the Ice. It takes place in Barrow, Alaska. Three young people go on a seal hunt, and only two come back. With us also the actress Karen Allen, who's one of the guiding spirits of the Berkshire International Film Festival, and has a film called White Irish Drinkers that will be showing tomorrow at the Mahewee Theater up here at noon. Let me just quickly mention, tonight, actually, I think Marco and Alric are bumping heads tonight. I think both of your movies are being showed in a Friday night slot tonight, right?
6:45 for On the Ice, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
6:30 for us.
All right, so...
So we should fight, huh?
So you have to make a choice. I'm going to have to make a choice tonight, you know, and I like both these guys, and the movies sound really interesting, and I may have to flip a coin or something. I forget when We Still Live Here comes up.
We Still Live Here is playing this afternoon at 4:30.
All right, so I can do that one without hurting anybody else's feelings. That's got to happen to you, Karen Allen, too. There's a lot of movies here, and first of all, it's like Sophie's Choice you have to choose, and probably a lot of people are saying, well, please come see my movie, right?
Yeah, and there are, you know, in my little program, there's two or three films I want to see almost on any given time slot, so it's challenging to try to pick one. You pick one and miss the other two. It's a drag.
You know, I was going to ask you, sort of, I think people listening to this who haven't been to a film festival and aren't filmmakers are kind of probably wondering what gets talked about. There are little cocktail parties here and there and chance encounters at coffee shops around Great Barrington. So what do filmmakers talk about when they run into one another?
I think, as Margo said, we do talk about the war stories, you know, what the huge challenges were in our projects, and we want to find out about other people's films. We want to find out what they've seen, what other filmmakers have seen that they like. And we just also want to laugh and relax. I mean, it's, you know, we've all been on a long, hard road to get here, and we just want to kick back a little bit, watch other people's films, appreciate, and hang out.
And there's a certain amount of relief when you're talking about things in the past, as opposed to, like you say, the hurdles that are coming up, you know?
Well, you said to me, you know, from your role as the kind of producer that you are, you're usually working on the next thing. You're not running around to festivals shepherding a film like this ordinarily. You're worried about something else that's brewing now.
Well, again, I mean, as I say, I see it very much, you know, I never lose the pragmatic business aspect of it. And, you know, when you care about a project, you live with it very intensely for a very long period of time. There does come a certain point where you have to let go, I believe. And also, you can't forget, I mean, especially nowadays, the pace that things move at. I mean, I guess it's kind of a joke, but, you know, okay, so what are you working on next? You know, is the first question out of people's mouths. It's not something you can lose sight of. I mean, you can't get so wrapped up in a project that it blots out 5 years. You know, you have to keep current with what the public wants, with what you're trying to do, new projects and whatnot.
I want to hear what other people have to say. What do people talk about, Alric Brown?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The film last night, Page One, the New York Times, there was a line in there that kind of summed, a moment in there summed it up. They were asking James Carr, the New York Times
columnist. David Carr, yeah.
David Carr about, you know, what it means to go to these conventions and stuff. And he said, you know, and I'll paraphrase it for filmmakers. We live in these caves where we're writing. We live on these sets and these far-off places. Coming to these film festivals, we get together and we can converge. Mm-hmm. We can congregate and we can, like, share our experiences and our journeys. And we're not alone. You know, we realize that we're not the only ones that are crazy, you know. And in the film, he says that. And we also wear badges. And so, you know, we all get to wear badges. We know that everything is all right.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Karen Allen, are we missing anything?
About what people talk about? In terms of conversations? Yeah. You know, mostly the people that I'm talking to are, you know, they just want to tell me about the films that they've seen, you know. And, you know, so we're kind of sharing information about, you know, what the stories are and what the films are and what everybody is going to see later. And so it's just film talk, a lot of film talk.
It's sort of interesting, you know, that movie that you're talking about, the New York Times one. You know, we sort of walked out of it. We weren't sure how we felt about it. But I've been walking around here. I think another thing that happens is you have conversations about the movies that you've seen. And you find yourself thinking about the movie a whole different way because, you know, you talk to so many different people about it. Actually, I thought the most chilling moment of the movie was there was a moment where David Carr is talking to, I think his name is Richard Perez Pena, one of the other media reporters at the New York Times, who says, what do you mean I've only got 15 years left? I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to be working here forever, you know? And he goes, and David Carr says, how old are you right now? And he says, 42. And he goes, listen, by the time you're 61 or 62, someone's going to tap you on the shoulder and say, your sheet cake's over there. You're done. And I thought,
turn in your tablet.
Having worked in the media a long time, I think that's... Yeah, turn in your tablet. So, you know, I mean, we're sort of alluding to right now, we've been talking a little bit about sort of how hard it is sometimes to get the film seen by as many people as you want, or to get the film made, or to get the next grant, to get the... I mean, are there things that you think would be easy to change structurally or in terms of, or attitudinally about this business that would make life better and easier? Not to say that life is horrible. I mean, it sounds like you're having a lot of fun and loving what you do, but you know, if you could wave a magic wand, are there things that would you'd love to see change?
I'd love to see more support for organizations like the NEA and the NEH and for arts in general. I think European countries have better support for the arts than we do here, and those places that do fund art and artistic film are endangered mm-hmm. here. So I'd like to wave a magic wand and grow the opportunities and the resources for that kind of support.
Any other ideas? Magic wand solutions?
Well, I definitely agree with that. More funding for the arts. And what's interesting now with technology is the ability to make a film, access just to make a film, it has become a lot easier. Mm-hmm. And there, we can debate whether that's good or not, mm-hmm. but the means of distribution are still very, very constrained and very closed. And, you know, if I could wave a wand, it would be find some way to open up those means of distribution so that films like the ones that we have can get out to audiences a little bit more than film festivals, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think that distribution model is in the process of changing. It's one of the most tumultuous aspects, I think, of the industry right now. And I think in some ways it is getting easier for independent filmmakers to get out there, at least to be able to access a great number of people. But the issue then becomes advertising and how you catch their attention to know where to look in the first place. If I can wave a magic wand, yeah, free advertising.
That's right. You talked about the limited advertising budget that you're going to have.
Yeah, you get sometimes wonderful reviews, but there's no way to let people know mm-hmm. that those reviews, you know, if they didn't happen to read it that one day in the newspaper mm-hmm. or in this magazine or whatever, then those reviews are gone. And if you don't have any advertising budget to really put it out there in a major way, those moments, you know, for a film, you know, a film can come and go fairly quickly.
As a side note, you know, especially for independent films, it's not uncommon to have a print and advertising budget that dwarfs the size of the budget of the actual film. And that's mm-hmm. how important the advertising is.
But it's got to be better, at least in the sense that, I mean, I certainly grew up in an era where you waited for somebody to show you the movie that they were going to show you. It was an entirely top-down relationship. And now, ultimately, I can type We Still Live Here or White Irish Drinkers or Kinyarwanda or On the Ice into Netflix search terms and even spell Kinyarwanda a little bit wrong, you know, and I'll be able to get a movie, which, I mean, if you think about how most of us have lived our lives, I mean, that's revolutionary, the idea that I could get a movie that I'd heard about on a show like this. Yes?
Yeah, it's comments? Fantastic. I'm a Netflix maniac, I would call myself.
Yeah.
I really take advantage of the Netflix world.
And I think also just the how multifarious cable has become. I mean, just there's sort of a lot of places. I mean, I guess you probably wish there were more sort of IFC-type channels that actually might show a movie like Kinyarwanda or On the Ice, right?
More channels, more outlets, just more outlets in general, but it has to be copied. That has to be followed by the advertising, like you mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, we're getting towards the end of this, and first of all, I want to thank everybody who helped out here today. We brought an amazing crew up here, as usual. The big kids came up. John Dankowski and Katie Tularski came up to help us run things. Kelly Vickery from the film festival has been so great, as has Sylvia Cancella. As usual, Mike crew, Patrick Scahill, and Kion Wolf are terrific to have around. And it's been such an honor to talk to all of you. I just want to say to everybody who's listening out here, you don't have to be a big shot to go to the Berkshire International Film blockbuster. It's one of the nice things about smaller film festivals is that, you know, you can go up here and plunk down some money and you can buy, I think you can still buy an individual ticket, or you can get a tag to wear around your neck. And I mean, my son and I were stuck in Sedona one time and we didn't even know there was a film festival happening, and we found it and we bought tags and we saw everything. And so if you're sitting out there in Hartford or New Haven right now and you think this is something you couldn't take part in, you're wrong. Get in the car, drive up Route 7, come to Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and you can see everything. Okay, thank you, Ann Makepeace, Karen Allen, Alaric Brown, and Marco Londoner. We gotta go. We'll be back sometime with something. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Kyone Wolf. Here's my movie idea. A passionate, likable voiceover actress travels to the Berkshire International Film Festival and meets Martin Scorsese, who happens to need a voice for his animated remake of Goodfellas. Oh, and there's a rap battle in there, too.